Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss self-care and integrated health. Evidence for a non-dualistic unity of body and mind. This philosophy appears in the East in Buddhist scriptures dating back to around the 8th century. The issue seems not to become an intellectual problem in the West until Descartes and Spinoza's writings in response to the overweening power of the church in the 17th century. This was the birth of modern science. Today we'll be talking with neuroscientist and author Dr. Antonio Damasio, whose three books, Descartes' Error, The Feeling of What Happens, and his latest, Looking for Spinoza, give us scientific basis to support a unity of the body-mind. Antonio Damasio is the Van Allen Professor and Head of the Department of Neurology at the University of Iowa Medical Center and is an adjunct professor at the Salk Institute in San Diego. Descartes' Error was nominated for the Los Angeles Times Book Award and has been translated into 23 languages. The Feeling of What Happens was a New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice, a Publisher's Weekly and Library Journal Best Book of the Year, and has 19 foreign editions. He lives in Iowa City and Chicago, and as I said, we're going to be discussing Looking for Spinoza, Joy, Sorrow, and the Feeling Brain. Welcome to you so much, Dr.
Thank you.
Damasio. How do you like to be addressed? Am I putting you on the spot by asking you that?
No, that's perfectly fine. Antonio, Dr. Damasio, whatever you please.
Now, this is interesting because I do detect a very delicate accent. And I, of course, wondered throughout reading this book whether, in fact, your ancestry is also a Sephardim.
Actually not, but I was born in Europe, and I was born in Lisbon, in Portugal. I'm not sure that you would ever detect the origin of my accent, but there you have it.
Well, but it does give me the origin of some of your heartfelt resonance with Spinoza's life, because it's very clear from the book that you feel strongly for him.
Certainly, but I think I would feel strongly for him even if there would not be any connection to Portugal.
I understand.
Because he deserves that kind of liking and that kind of admiration, I believe.
I agree, very much so. To start out, I would like you, if you could, to give me some sense of what you think non-pathological causes would be for people to split themselves in two, because I honestly have never understood this tendency that people have.
I think it has a little bit to do with the fact that if we look at ourselves without the kind of information we have from modern science, it is reasonable to look to one side at the body, which obviously is something very easily observable, very physical, with a beginning and an end, and on the other, to look at our own minds, which one has the impression that are not quite connected to one's body, that have their own life, their independence. It is not unreasonable to have seen it that way from a very naive point of view. And I think that that's actually the origin of that split. It is, of course, a split that was celebrated for religious reasons and maintained for religious reasons. And, of course, that's one of the great beauties of Spinoza's contribution, is that he saw that that was not necessary. And even with the limited knowledge of science that he had in the 17th century, he was able to say, this does not make sense, and we have these two things together coming out of the same substance, and in fact they have different appearances, mind to one side, body to the other, but there's no reason why they should not be connected. There's no reason why they should not be part and parcel of the same organism. But even Spinoza did recognize that the manifestations seem different, that body and mind have different appearances sort of to the naked eye. But the bigger issue is that even those different manifestations don't need to be corresponding to a reality of different substances, as Descartes, for example, would have wanted.
Well, for the people who are listening who have not read all of your books in progression, it might be interesting to go back just a tad and explain what kind of led you to... I understand that your research and your clinical work is what inspired you eventually to go back to Spinoza's writings, but I think there's a progression in your book, starting with Descartes' error. So yeah. If you could give us some kind of framework for those who haven't read your books.
Right. I think that my research, of course, starts at a different point, starts actually with a very strong interest in brain and mind, but that was focused for the most part on processes of language and processes of memory and reasoning. And at a certain point, I was confronted with the fact that there were certain kinds of patients, neurological patients that is, that would lose their ability to reason properly, and in fact, the source of that problem was a problem with the running of their emotions. And it is because of being confronted by patients who, on the face of it, had a problem with one particular kind of mental process, specifically reasoning, but turned out to have, as the source of that problem, something that was emotion, that was in fact very much related to the way our bodies function and our bodies reflect themselves on the mind. It was really because of that that I was led into both my research on emotion and my concern for the relation between mind and body. If it had not been for the fact that my work on emotion made me confront this constant mixing of body signals and mental signals, perhaps I would not have been so keen on looking into that problem and revisiting that problem. So that's really how it begins. And the reason why my first book, which came after many years of research on the subject, was called Descartes' Error, is that my research inevitably led me to believe that, in fact, body and mind could not be split in terms of their substance, in terms of their basis, the way Descartes proposed. And for our listeners who may not know what Descartes proposed, in a nutshell, he said that on the one hand, you have the mind, on the other, you have the body, and so far, we would not be terribly away from Spinoza. But then he said that the two processes, mind and body, were entirely based on different substance. The body was, in fact, a substance that was very easily definable, that had, as Descartes said, an extension, had a beginning and a middle and an end, whereas the mind existed in some special space that did not have extension, that did not have beginning and end, and that really could not be pinned down. And then, to make matters even a little bit more complicated, he made the two connected at one point in our brain known as the pineal gland. And that's exactly where he lost me.
Yeah. This is early research into melatonin production, I think.
That's right.
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, it serves the purposes of theism, monotheism. To have the body be of the earth and be something that it decays and has appetites that are disgusting, and that the mind is the spirit, it's the spirit. But in Descartes' error, we encounter this problem of having to make decisions, and how it is that we make decisions on our own behalf. And this is where we begin to encounter, I think, some of these concepts that you call brain mapping,
yeah,
versus body states, and how it benefits the organism to have this kind of sense experience in order to make decisions. So why don't you give us some explanation of brain mapping?
Right. So the fundamental idea, perhaps, let's start with this idea, is the idea that when we make decisions, we do not base our decisions exclusively on knowledge and exclusively on our reasoning capacity, our logic, for example. We also have, in the way decisions are made, a guidance that comes from emotions. And comes from emotions in terms of our experience of the past, and comes from emotions in terms of the experience of other species before us. For example, when an animal makes a decision of running away from a predator because the animal senses danger, that decision is a very correct decision and one that will save the animal's life. And it is a decision that in its outer aspects is very similar to the kinds of decisions we make all the time on a variety of issues. But lo and behold, it's a decision that was made by emotion itself. It's emotion in a very natural way through the process of evolution that endows that particular animal with the possibility of running away from a source of danger. The animal didn't really think through that decision in the way we may think. We think through decisions when we're trying to opt for a certain investment or opt for a certain relationship. The decision was, in fact, accomplished by this very natural emotional system that the animal inherited from evolution. Well, that emotional decision is, in fact, played out in the body, and it is something that exists in this very close tie-up between body and mind. In a way, the body executes the decision, and then the mind can picture what has happened in relation to the object that caused it and in relation to its result, to how it feels. But it is something that is played out in the entire organism with this great unity of body and mind. And in humans, there is a system that is very similar in the sense that it incorporates everything that we have had in other species through millions of years of evolution. And in addition, we then have the possibility of creating a whole new, very human mode of decision that is based on all that natural knowledge, plus on our own reflection on past events, our own reflection in terms of our culture, that sort of enlarges that capacity that came out of emotion and out of the body and projects it into a larger mental and social realm.
So what simplistically, what we might also say here is that emotions that are often considered to be unpleasant or negative, like fear, in fact, are a very important part of prudent decision-making.
Quite correctly, yeah. And I think that the very interesting point to make is this, is that in a way, everything that has come to us from evolution, from our natural history, as emotions, whether it be fear or sadness, happiness, surprise, pride, compassion, you name it, all of these emotions were incorporated in our makeup because at one point or another, they were extremely helpful for a living organism to survive and to survive with well-being. So directly or indirectly, emotions always led to survival and to well-being. Now, it does not mean that all of them are equally capable of doing so today. For example, fear remains a very important emotion, even for an urban human in 2003, obviously. We can save our lives with fear in certain circumstances. However, there are circumstances where fear is completely misapplied and should not be engaged and is, in fact, going to stress our organisms and make us have disease instead of well-being. So it doesn't follow that just because it was once very helpful, it's going to remain helpful. Another example would be anger. Obviously, many animals in the history of life have been saved by anger, because anger can be a very strong defense mechanism against an attack by another individual. However, in most circumstances in cultural life today, anger is actually very counterproductive. It doesn't really lead to good conflict resolution, and it doesn't lead to much good in terms of our own health. If you are the angry person, you're going to suffer probably more than the person that is the target of your own anger. So it's what this points to is this remarkable situation in which we find ourselves today, is that by knowing more and by understanding the extreme complexity of the mechanisms of emotions, of these mechanisms of mind and body relationship, we have a chance of deciding intelligently which ones are good, which ones are not so good, which ones we should cultivate and which ones we should try to do away with because they're not good for us as individuals or for the other individuals that are around us in terms of a social setting.
Ah, but here we have a potential for a debate, and I say that cautiously because I really don't feel that I'm up to debating you, but what it brings up for me is, simplistically, because you've just said a mouthful, and I hope that people are tracking us a bit.
We can break it all in parts.
No, I think so. But let me sort of give you a sense of where I'm going, and it was a place that I was going while I was reading your book. I found myself going back and forth between Spinoza's ideas and also the quest for joy and the sense of sorrow being a negative emotion and maybe not being healthful. And here's where I went with that. When I read Spinoza, what I feel from him is something very similar to what I see in these ancient yogic Eastern religions, like Buddhism in particular, where we suddenly find things like the wheel, the Abhidharma wheel, which is a system of psychological, a system that actually shows you how, as you talk about in the book, how an emotion arises and then there's a feeling and then there's another emotional and it starts going around and around, and how through meditation and training the mind you can begin to stop yourself at any given moment on that wheel instead of, as you say, acting inappropriately in a social situation so that it harms you and the other person. On the other hand, Buddhism is not only non-dualistic in its approach to the body-mind, it's also non-dualistic in its approach to all states of being, that all of them are something that can be observed and experienced without attachment. And the goal here is a lack of attachment rather than the cessation of something negative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because equanimity is not going to be achieved by saying, ugh, I'm angry, I have to stop that now. And so you start tightening your tushy and you don't feel any anger, you know. So, I mean, that's not going to work. You're going to end up in a world of trouble that way, too. So it brings up this whole issue of maladaptation, not only socially, but from, you know, when you start talking about innate or adaptive memory, you know, in the organism, even ancient organisms, you're almost talking about something that you could say is almost like cellular memory. So how far back does our experience go? Do we have the experiences of trauma from our ancestors, for instance, and have we actually in our DNA some kind of cellular memory of that that makes us go eek in situations that maybe we shouldn't need to go eek in?
Right. Well, you know, the answer, quite frankly, is that we don't know. We don't know how. And what we do know is that in simpler organisms than we are, and in the genome of those organisms, there are certain commands for the creation of an organism in a particular way and for the possibility of responding to the world with certain reactions, which include these emotions that we were talking about. And on top of it, there is also the possibility of individual learning. So that each and every one of us, and of course many other species beyond us, before us, if you will, have not only a repertoire of reactions that are given and that are either purely innate or almost entirely innate, as well as many other reactions that are learned with our individual experience. So, for example, you and I are very likely to respond emotionally in a very similar way to a variety of things that someone could present us with. For example, certain pieces of music, certain landscapes, certain paintings, or certain faces of people. However, there would also be a range of objects or of situations that you and I would respond to with different emotions, perhaps just differences in intensity, or maybe even a complete difference of the sort that one particular thing could evoke great joy in you and not evoke any joy at all in me. So there is a part in every one of us that is shared with our other fellow humans, and in fact, in certain circumstances, with many of our many of the species that came before us, and there are also many other things that are the result of the unique individual experience that each and every one of us has had across a lifetime. And that's really what makes us as rich as we are, is this combination of what has been inherited and what has been shaped by circumstances that are absolutely unique for each and every one, because they have to do with when we were born, how we interacted, who was around us, who led our life in the early years, and so on.
Well, and in fact, it can't really be reduced to just how the neurons in our brain interact or fire, or, you know what I mean? It's not all, it's not reductionistic.
Not at all. And I think that it's very important for people to understand these nuances, because it's very tempting, you know, neuroscience in particular has been so successful, in biology in general, at explaining how systems operate in our organism, how the brain does a number of things. It's obvious that we don't know everything, not even near it, but we have had great success in the past few decades. And when you look at the enormous amount of knowledge that we have gathered about our brain in the past 10 years, it's really remarkable, and we are making a huge movement forward. They're great advances. But there's also the fact that in spite of these advances, we cannot have the sense that all of it is explainable very readily by how a network operates. First of all, we don't fully know how it operates. But then there's something more. It's important to distinguish what is inherited from what is acquired in unique circumstances, which we just talked about. And then you have the fact that the uniqueness comes in part from a unique environment that each and every one of us has. So there's uniqueness in the environment in terms of what's around us, for example, physically. What kind of landscape were we born into and grew up with? But also the social and cultural landscape in which we are developing. All of those different aspects are a very important part of how we develop our organism, and especially how we develop it in the most tender aspect of it, which has to do with the creation of these relations between mental and bodily aspects that construct our mental profile.
It occurs to me that it is really recent that we begin to see scientists looking to philosophy or this bridging of the philosophical thought and I might say spiritual thought, not in necessarily in this case, but in some other cases, into science. This is relatively new, and it makes me wonder if the reason that this book was important, these books, this series of books, and this one in particular, whether, you know, who actually wrote these books for? Are these books really written for the scientific community in a sense?
Yes, they are, but not only for the scientific community. You know, it's very curious because, you know, someone in my position does most of the writing purely for scientific colleagues. So, you know, I have written far more pages of scientific articles that are published in scientific journals than I have written books, at least the books that are aimed at a broader public, which are this particular three. When I wrote these, the first of these books, it was largely a book for scientific colleagues and for a few other specialists in different areas who can be broadly termed colleagues in the sense that they would be in specialties that would have a very close relationship with neuroscience, for example, psychology or anthropology. And in a way, it was the fact that that first book was so well received by many people outside of the scientific community that made me think that it was worth continuing to write for that larger public. And the main reason was that I learned so much from talking to people that probably I would not have talked to after that first book. But basically, all the books were conceived in a way which is, you know, they're not really looking at what has been accomplished as much as they're looking at what potentially can be accomplished if we think in a certain way. So it's almost like sharing both past knowledge and your plans for the future with a much larger audience than that which would be constituted by your immediate colleagues. And what I have found is that there is a very avid public out there that in fact goes even beyond the specialties that could have a connection to brain studies, because as you know, right now almost anyone in almost any specialty can make a connection to brain studies. But there are many more people that are interested and that are eager to learn more about how one can think through these problems.
Antonio,
you're one of them.
We're talking with Antonio Damasio. I neglected to let you know that at a midpoint because we were so deeply in conversation here. His newest book is Looking for Spinoza, and we do need to take a brief music break here now. I'm Lena Berman. You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. Please stay with us, and we'll be right back with our interview with Antonio Damasio. I just want to remind you that if you miss parts of today's show or want to get a cassette copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call my information number 24 hours at 707-874-2772. Dr. Damasio, do you have any contact information other than just people getting the book? You don't have a website or anything for them to keep tabs on your work?
Well, there is a website for the Department of Neurology at the University of Iowa. And that can be a source.
And what is the URL for that? Well, they can just type into it's University of Iowa, and
that's correct. That will give them access to the medical center and to the Department of Neurology.
Department of Neurology in the med center. So if you type into your search engine. University of Iowa Medical Center, Department of Neurology, and you can look for Damasio, which is spelled D-A-M-A-S-I-O.
Perfect.
Yeah, I was tentative there because I've just dropped my interview. So, oh, somebody's here. We go. Thank you. I thought, let me not do this incorrectly, please. Let me ask you something.
Sure.
We're going to here now, I think, talk a bit about. I want to kind of bring Spinoza back in and talk about feeling as a guide and how what feelings are for. But let me ask you something. This work, how does it work for you in the pursuit of your joy? It's hooking you in some emotional way, clearly. But so far, when you talk about it, you know, you're very I don't want to say anything. It sounds critical. You're magnificent to listen to, and your writing is magnificent. But I'm wondering where the heat is for you on this.
Well, you know, it's there are many ways in which it rewards you. I guess the primary reward comes from the joy of discovery.
Yeah.
If you ask me what makes me happy and what makes me come back for more in terms of writing, is actually the fact that when you write, you discover, because of course you have done quite a lot of work in the laboratory, you have run experiments, you have made studies, you have discussed them, but there's a moment in which you have to put it all down in words, and in which you have in which you're thinking about a particular listener, reader, who is going to get your message. And in that moment of attempting to make your ideas clear to someone else, you actually very often make those ideas more clear, if you're lucky, I guess, because probably there are many circumstances in which you may not. But if all is going well, you will make the ideas more clear, and you end up discovering more things than you actually thought you knew. And there's an enormous pleasure that comes from making things fit, making things clear, and having understanding in general. And here you have a perfect connection to Spinoza. Maybe that was one of the things that attracted me so much to Spinoza, is that he was absolutely clear about the fact that knowledge in itself, gaining knowledge, gaining understanding, gaining clarity over the world in general, the universe in general, but perhaps you even in particular, would create a lot of joy. In fact, I'm convinced that that was one of the main sustaining joys of his life, was the fact that he was always in this process of analysis and reflection and therefore discovery. So that's probably, in a nutshell, what does it for me. Wait, and then there are other maybe minor aspects. You know, I happen to love words. I happen to love the process of making a sentence clear, if possible, and more beautiful, if possible. This is something that attracts me very much. So that gives some pleasure in itself. But it's not the main source. The main source is this gaining of some clarity and the sense you have that you're transmitting it to someone else who will also enjoy and respond to it.
Spinoza, in various ways, at various times, said that the object of the mind is the body, that the body is almost the ground.
Yep.
You know, from which these things, maybe not from which, but about which or together with the body, these things arise. I would like you to explain what your understanding is of what feelings are for.
Yeah, can we backtrack a minute?
Of course, yes.
That when you, just to situate feeling in relation to
emotion,
that will help.
Okay.
So if one could give an example. If you call me and give me some very good news about something, what that piece of good news that you've just given me constitutes is what I call in my latest book the emotionally competent stimulus. In other words, it is the thing, the object, the situation that is going to trigger the process of emotion. And the emotion is going to be this reaction, which can be laughter or a face of merriment and pleasure and so on. And it's a very complex reaction that literally changes the state of your body, or in the very least, changes the state of the maps of your body in your brain. We can go into this. I don't want to make it too complicated, but let's assume that it changes your body. And we don't have any doubt that it does. This is, of course, what any emotion will do, is change the momentary condition of your body. What happens next, and it happens very fast, in fact, we're talking about a matter of milliseconds to get there, is that these changes in the body that are plotted in the maps of the body inside our brain form the basis for what is called feeling. So what is a feeling? A feeling is the way in which our mind represents body changes that occurred during an emotion and that occurred because there was a certain object that caused that emotion. So we really bring it all together. It's like a funny little cycle. You begin with the causative object, which in our example would have been you calling me with some good news. You then go on to change the body as a result of the emotion. And then you map those changes in another part of the brain, and it is that map, or actually those maps, because there's always more than one, that form the basis for feeling. And then feeling becomes that mental map, but it joins up with the object that caused it. So you sort of a ring around a rose. You begin with the object, you go to the body, you go to the maps, you create the feeling, and you're there joined with the object that it's all about.
Let me just make one quick comment. You used the example in the book, which I think is a really good one for the reader to experience it, which is to imagine yourself lying on an absolutely perfect day,
right,
on the most beautiful beach you can imagine, and just how the sensations of pleasure create in your mind a different state, and how,
yeah,
then your body cooperates with that, and pretty soon you have a series of progression of thoughts,
yeah,
which kind of, you know what this reminds me of is, I have a favorite film that most people hate, which is the original version of Angels of Desire, the Wim Wenders film, which depicts angels as interceding in situations where humans are in trouble and putting their hands on their shoulders and putting their heads against them so that their progression of feelings shifts.
Uh-huh.
Their thoughts, you know, yep, when someone is dying and an angel comes to him and starts saying, he's going, oh my God, what will I do if I die, my family, my children, and then the angel comes by and starts saying, ice cream on a hot day, sunset, and and all of these life, and for me, and the guy survives because,
right,
of it. So that this was a nice metaphor for,
right,
the part of our brain which has a way of pulling us out of,
right,
these dangerous states. So there is this thing about progression. It's very much like that wheel from the,
yeah,
Abhidharma.
Absolutely. But then once we look at feeling in this way, then one can try to answer your question, which is a beautiful but very complicated question, or a very complicated answer, which is, what do feelings do for us? I think that's what you ask. Well, what feelings do for us is something very curious. Is allow us to be aware of what has happened during an emotion. And as I say in Looking for Spinoza, it allows us to generate a concern for what goes on during an emotion. So why is this important? Imagine that instead of being a very complex organism like we are, we would be something very, very simple. You know, one of the simple species, for example, a simple snail that has very little brain and is actually very simple in its organization, but who does have emotions in the sense that it has reactions of a certain kind, and different reactions at that, to different kinds of stimuli. What that creature does have is something which is a reaction, which is important for its survival, and in fact maybe quite helpful, but unless there is a possibility of plotting it mentally, of having the mental counterpart of that reaction, there is no way of knowing it in the proper sense of the term, and there is no way of using that knowledge. Obviously, if you don't have it, you can't use it. What we humans have, and many, many other species as well, of course, is that we not only emote in relation to some kind of object, but we also become aware of that emotion in relation to that object. And what that allows us is really spectacular, is that we can start to build, from obviously very early on in our lives, sort of classes, categories of reactions that we have in relation to certain objects. And that's why you and I, at any given moment when you enter a room or come into a different city or look around ourselves, we have this sort of automatic sense of the things that can potentially bring us harm or be good and nurturing, the things that will be pleasant, things that will be unpleasant, the things that will have all of this large range of effects on ourselves. It's because not only do we react blindly, but in addition, we know that we reacted, and we have this possibility of building knowledge of our reactions over time and building categories of knowledge, having a whole system of reflection on what our interaction is with the universe around us.
And this brings me to an important point, I think, which is that I believe that, unless I've misunderstood your writing, that in some sense you are advocating the concept that we might be capable of creating or recreating ourselves each moment. And
yes.
And so what we do in another way is, if you go back to the writings of Robert Sapolsky, if you really understand the consequences of becoming overwhelmed in a stressful situation and not dealing, in other words, understanding the stress response in the body and understanding what chemistry goes on in the body and what changes happen to the body, you then, if you're in traffic and you're getting yourself very stressed out, can at that moment say, okay, wow, this is going too far, I'm hurting myself. So there are some decisions that can be made if you're paying attention.
Correct.
Right.
Exactly. That's one. That's a very good example. It's very simple, but it's very good. It's one way of intervening in the process. So to put it in very simple terms, the best answer for your question on what does feeling bring to us? Feeling, in a way, liberates us from the tyranny of blind emotion. If we did not have feelings available, we would never have been able to build on a knowledge, to build a knowledge about how we emote in the world. But if we do have that possibility of feeling, and if, of course, we are conscious and we have a memory system and a reasoning system, then we have a chance of building this knowledge. And that knowledge is truly liberating, because no longer are we necessarily limited by our natural reactions. We also can intervene and say, sometimes not so easy, but we can, no, I'm not going to do that. And your example is perfect for that. No, I'm not going to get into this stressed out situation. I'm going to try to control it.
Now, this brings us to another very important issue, because this, of course, is a health show, which is how we care for ourselves. And one of the things that frustrates me is the way in which our medical system has encouraged people to become passive in relationship to their doctors and their health care, and they just sort of give off, you know, they sort of more into the Descartes thing. They show up with their brain and they hand over their bodies.
Absolutely.
And
you know, you're absolutely right. I think it's extremely frustrating, and it comes from that split of body and mind which pervades Western medicine. And, you know, I'm not going to badmouth Western medicine.
Oh, you can on this show.
No, we have, you know, Western medicine.
Oh, it's important. Yeah,
is important, and is an enormous history of success. There, of course, huge things that have been learned and that are very important for humanity. But it could be so much better, and I think it will be so much better when people realize that when you have a so-called physical ailment, the chances of that physical ailment being purely physical, quote-unquote, is fairly small. For example, when you show up at your doctor with heart disease or with high blood pressure or with arthritis, there are a few conditions which might be attributable purely to the circumstances of your metabolism, for example. But
or what you're eating or your lifestyle.
Right. But there are many, many circumstances that are, in fact, in many circumstances, those conditions have, in part, in fact, in many cases, in a large part, been caused by a series of problems and events that would be easily describable by anybody as mental events, things that have occurred more in the mind and in one's social interactions than in the body in the traditional view.
Well, let me just comment, because I agree and disagree with you. Let me just also very quickly say I'm on the phone with Antonio Damasio. His new book is Listening to Spinoza, and I'm Lena Berman. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. One of the problems with the sort of newer thing that's happening in integrative medicine of integrating the mind into the body's health and, again, splitting it apart is that there is this kind of blaming the victim, simplistically blaming the victim for their illness. And where I think that this is important is not so much that people allow so-called negative states of mind, which I don't like calling them negative, because even things that are, like if you start talking about cholesterol, people say bad and good cholesterol. Well, there's no bad cholesterol. You have to have both. So I don't like to split it that way. What I'd like to say instead is a possibility is that not paying attention, not allowing yourself to feel the actual brain mapping that goes on. In other words, if you're not really paying attention to your state in every way, and if you don't listen to how your body speaks back to you or how you integrate yourself in various ways, it leaves you open for lifestyle decisions. And it leaves you to being afraid or adverse to looking at your maybe genetic disposition and not caring for yourself. So I think it's more that than just that people get scared and so they get arthritis.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No. I would agree with you. And I think that what one has to have is a very open mind and realize that, first of all, Western medicine has made contributions that are decisively important for one's welfare. There's no question about it. But then look into an opening so that we don't see things as purely physical or purely mental, because there's really no such things, are in very extreme ways. But just think of the example that there are mental events, quote-unquote, that have a very large influence on how the body events continue,
very
and vice
so.
Versa. Another very good example in the inverse direction is how a patient with, for example, cancer has a variety of changes in terms of its so-called mental operation that need to be addressed to as well. It is not just treating the cancer. There are other things. And I think that medicine in many quarters has realized this, and I think that, by the way, every good physician in the old good sense of the term always knew that. We're not making any big discovery here. But I think that it's a question of bringing these proportions sort of being somewhat more balanced in current practices. And I think we're going to get there.
I'm interested in getting your opinion about something. Since we've been talking about how important it is for people to actually pay attention to all of the sensations, you know, I mean, I made a case for not turning away from the negative emotion because that's information. But I'm wondering what your opinion is of the use of psychotherapy, for instance, because it illuminates the roots of sorrow, and then that can release people from these very destructive behaviors that... A very simple example is how many people who are suffering from chronic illness, if you begin to interview them, I mean, in my practice, when I talk to individuals who come to me with chronic illness, There are some very simple things that they're not doing, and it's striking. You know, are you resting enough?
Yeah.
Well, no, actually, I push myself. I have to worry. You know, are you eating three times a day? You know, just really simplistic. Are you caring for yourself? And there is this fleeing from. So, in other words, just how people are so influenced, and how much that influences their capacity for stress-related illness.
So
back to therapy, I'm wondering what your sense is of illuminating the negative in order to get keys to unlock these habituated activities.
I think it's extremely useful, and I think that, you know, I'm no expert on what are the best avenues, what are the best modes of therapy, but there are many available, and I think they're extremely useful. And I think they're extremely useful both to illuminate the negative and the positive. I think that there are possibilities of understanding more, or for an individual to understand more about himself and herself, and I think that that's very important. So I think that in wherever it appears advisable, I would certainly be in favor of it. I think that some people do their own therapy, but not all, probably not most. And so I think I'm totally in favor of it.
Let's go to the frontal lobe for a second before we run out of time utterly.
Okay.
It's very interesting. There are two things that I'm thinking here. One is it's very interesting to discover what happens when the frontal lobe is damaged. And there's lots of stuff in your book about people. Who, and then the other thing I want to get to, too, is your sense of what the problem is with people. Well, let's do one at a time. Let's go to frontal lobe damage. What interesting thing happens? Because I think head trauma is ignored as a possible reason for what might be considered sociopathic behavior.
Yep.
So,
yes. I think there's quite a lot of evidence that when you have damage to certain brain structures, and the frontal lobe are easily some of the most important in this regard, your social behavior changes. And it may change in a very sort of innocent way that may have mostly bad consequences to the person. But it may change in circumstances that may also make it difficult for those around the person. So there's no question that certain parts of the frontal lobe, once they are damaged, even if the frontal lobe has been perfectly normal and if the person has not had any disease until the day of the problem, once the damage starts, you have a significant problem of social behavior. You don't interact with others the same way. You're no longer the same responsible person that you may have been until that point.
And I guess we have no tools at this point for that.
Right. I think that the tools we have right now are extremely poor. I think that people, in fact, had not tumbled on to this problem until quite recently. This is something that we are now becoming more and more aware, and we're becoming aware also of the varieties that the problem may assume. And so the time to develop the tools is going to come now. Can we solve the problems completely? I'm not sure. Time will tell. We certainly need, in the very least, first of all, to recognize the problem and then to provide some kind of support in the environment of these individuals so that they are protected from themselves and that others are protected as well. And so that's the very least that can be done. And I think that with some, you know, you cannot talk in general about everyone. In some circumstances, with a good support system of relatives or friends or caretakers, you can actually do a lot, and you can certainly prevent disastrous consequences. But whether or not we're going to be able to find a treatment that will be more complete, we don't know. I don't think, for example, that in these cases psychotherapy is going to be of help. So we are limited. We're really limited. On the other hand, we are also learning quite a lot about our own functioning from the studies of such individuals, and that's a contribution that, in a way, those individuals are making by leading us into those new facts.
There is some very, very exciting research. I just recently interviewed William Walsh, who is a biochemist who is using orthomolecular medicine, specifically amino acid therapies and other imbalances. He's discovered faulty protein metabolism and things like that, that he's been able to make a difference in pathological individuals. But that's,
yep. Well,
that's interesting. But yeah,
it's definitely something. Something to be considered.
Okay, and then lastly, you make a case against using alcohol and other, I'm assuming, the other things that would be self-medication as a way of getting to joy. You discourage people from doing this.
Well, I don't know if I do it in so many words. I mean, certainly I wouldn't encourage anyone from becoming an alcoholic.
Well, I think I understood.
I have to tell you that as a neurologist, I think it's an extremely good idea to have some wine, which will probably be very good for your metabolism and will keep your arteries and the heart in better shape, so that you don't damage your brain. So, I think that my idea is very simple. I don't like the idea. I don't think it's a good solution to become happy or less stressed by consuming a medication that may temporarily make you happier, but not dealing with the problems that you ought to deal with.
Yeah, well, it's very anti-Spinoza. I mean, I think what Spinoza is a call to is to embrace and, as I said, sort of show up and pay attention to
exactly the
minutiae and the details, and that actually there's a certain lyricism and beauty in taking that kind of detail into consideration, and as you may not have said in so many words, but still you may be able to recreate yourself in each moment that way.
Absolutely. And so you need to, there's some reward for hard work.
Yeah.
In a way, you need to find a virtue in discovery, and of course, it's not just self-discovery; it's self-discovery and discovery of others, because
you're
never alone. Hopefully, what you discover for yourself, provided it's in the right context, will also be good for the other.
Yeah, and as Spinoza points out, what's good for the other is good for you.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Too bad Spinoza isn't president of our country right now.
That's right.
Yeah,
it would be a great person to have.
Yeah, he would be a wonderful president. I'm glad you like that. I do too. Maybe that's a bumper sticker, Spinoza for president.